talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the new Anne Frank exhibition in New York and what the Holocaust teaches us about the threats and challenges of today. How bilingual street signs in Dublin were part of a silent rebellion and what they reveal about our cultural heritage. And to end the show, mudlarking in London and what has been hidden in the Thames River for thousands of years. And we begin tonight's show with that new exhibition on Anne Frank in New York. Anne Frank was more than just a victim of the Nazi genocide. She was a writer and a symbol of resilience and strength. Her diary is among the most translated books in history, and today her voice continues to inspire. A brilliant new exhibition brings Anne's story beyond Amsterdam. Running at the Center for Jewish History in New York City, the immersive exhibition recreates the secret annex where Anne, her family and four others hid from Nazi persecution. Featuring over 100 original artifacts from the Anne Frank House, including never-before-seen items, it offers visitors a deeper understanding of Anne, and it's running until the 31st of October this year. And to talk to me about it, I'm delighted to welcome Tom Brink, the head of collections and presentations at the Anne Frank House. Tom, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell me about this experience? Because it is something that has never happened before, recreating the annex outside of Amsterdam for the first time ever.
Yeah, that is correct. And you know, it's not the entire exhibition is more than just a recreation of the hiding place of the annex. What we have done is we kind of made an exhibition in which you walk through Anne's life and also her afterlife, because her diary, of course, only was published after she died. And the centerpiece, I would say, of this exhibition is the recreation of the hiding place. But what we're trying to do is give a complete picture of her life.
And why New York City and why now?
Well, why now is, to be honest, it is now. But of course, these kind of things take time. So we've been working on this for quite a while. And we at Anne Frank House, now, if you come to Amsterdam and you want to visit the house, the museum, then you might run into an issue. And that means that we're kind of always sold out. There are so many people who want to visit the house, and there's only that many tickets available. And there's another thing that many people, as you know, of course, as everybody knows, Anne Frank is worldwide known, well-known. She's very famous, and people from all over the world would like to visit the Anne Frank House, but they're not in the circle. I mean, not everyone can travel to Amsterdam. So I think these are the two main reasons. People who come to Amsterdam can often not get a ticket because they're sold out, but also many people cannot come to Amsterdam. So we decided on trying to, kind of do an exhibit somewhere else. And why New York? Well, I think that New York is a wonderful place to start. I really hope that this exhibition will travel, but New York is like, it has always been an important city and location in family life, not only for Anne, but also for her father, who went to New York in 1910 and 1911. He worked at Macy's. He did an internship at Macy's because he knew Nathan Strauss, who was the son of the owner of Macy's, and he traveled to New York every now and then at a time. But also after the diary, Anne's diary was published in 1947, New York has been instrumental in bringing that story across the entire world, because there was the play on Broadway, there was the movie that premiered in New York in the 1950s. So New York has always been an important place in this history, and that's why we thought it is a brilliant place to kick off this hopefully traveling exhibition, but that remains to see.
Oh, well, that would be absolutely incredible if it travels further around and who knows, might even come to Dublin someday as well. And it's very important that the exhibition, it doesn't just show Anne as a victim. It's actually also celebrating her life. It's what she represents, what she symbolizes, the significance of that diary and the impact that she had in the world once that diary was published.
Absolutely. It is, I mean, she is undeniably, she is a victim of the Holocaust. And of course, we tell that story as well. But she was so much more. She was just a girl, as any girl. And she decided at one point in time to write a diary or to start a diary, as many, many girls do, boys as well, but especially girls. And in the end, she turned out to be a terrific, a tremendous good writer. And not only because she was very observant in The Hiding Place, especially, and we can read that in the diary, that she paints this very colorful picture of what is going, of what is happening in The Hiding Place and the people who were with her in The Hiding Place. But also she has, like, we see a worldview that in spite of everything that she has to endure is still, like, very humanistic and full of optimism. And I think that is what makes her a symbol of, well, like, resilience. And also she's still inspiring to many young people around the world.
And of course, this is a time when we see a rise in anti-Semitism, a rise in hate towards various groups. We see various threats in society, threats to democracy. It's important that the story of Anne Frank is told, it's retold, and that the lessons are learned from it.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's exactly as you say. Like, the exhibition starts in Frankfurt before she was born, and that was before 1929. Anne was born in 1929, but before that year, the Franks and the Hollanders, who is Edith Hollander, Anne's mother, these were Jewish families in Germany, but as Otto himself said, they were as Jewish as they were German. Otto fought in the German army in the First World War. He was an officer, actually. And so they were completely, like, integrated and assimilated into that society. And then at once, and that is kind of 1929, of course, is a very important year in that, not only because Anne was born, but more because it was the year of the stock exchange crash and the economic crisis. And then things start going down in Germany, and all at once the Jews in Germany are, as the Nazis say, they are the problem. I mean, like, up till then, of course, there was anti-Semitism, but it was not that stark, it was not that structured, and all at once they were not wanted anymore in their own country. And we see that although it was a weak democracy between the two world wars in Germany, we see that within a couple of months, when Hitler comes to power, that democracy turns into a flat-out dictatorship. And that goes so fast. I mean, Anne was born in the democracy, and only a couple of years later, they had to move because the land had become unlivable, had become a dictatorship. And we should never forget that. In the end, Hitler came to power through elections. So that is one of the things that we address in the exhibition as well. And I think that, and the other thing you mentioned, of course, there is a lot of anti-Semitism. It has been rising for the last years, but also hatred toward other groups. And that is, of course, Anne's life and her work is explicitly a warning against that.
And taking her story all the way up to her death at Bergen-Belsen, the concentration camp, when she was only 15 years old. And you seem to have been determined to find innovative ways to tell the story using video, sound, photography, animation, artifacts as well. That it's this way of making the history accessible to modern audiences.
Absolutely. You know, an important target group of the exhibition is young people, and in particular students and pupils. So what we did is we tried to find a way to not make, not design a classical exhibition in terms of we have objects, of course, we have objects and showcases, and we have text. But what we have done is we try to kind of combine, exactly as you say, the different approaches and different technologies. Every segment of the exhibition, like, it starts with, as I said, in Frankfurt, is kind of a classical, it's a spectacular design, but it is kind of a classical exhibition with showcases and objects, and we tell that story. But then we come to Amsterdam in 1940-1942, which are the first 2 years of the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands, and that is a video, like an immersive immersive video on three walls, and we get the Jewish community got literally hundreds and hundreds of anti-Jewish measures in those 2 years. And what we tried to do is give them kind of through this audiovisual projection, give the impact of what happened to the Jewish community, the complete isolation, the one anti-Jewish measure after the other, they were completely robbed. So that is the idea, is to make it some kind of an overwhelming experience. And then it comes to the point that the family has to go into hiding, and you literally step into the hiding place, which is, again, another completely different approach. It is there, it is silent, and it is like, yeah, it is a real hiding place. And that is a different feel than the immersive video and then the like the artifacts exhibition. So we try to come up with different ways to tell this story. And that seems to work quite well, because we see that, and we have already had more than 20,000 students visiting the exhibition, that they're really touched by what they see. And I think that is a good thing, because that is where empathy starts, and that is where everything starts.
And I think it is important that students are going to see it, because thanks to philanthropic funding, tickets are free for New York City public schools, Title I public schools across the United States. They'd be the equivalent of DESH schools here in Ireland. They're able to go free of charge. There's an accompanying curriculum that's being developed that provides this resource for teachers, that it is very important that the younger generation learns about Anne's story, learns about what the world was like then, and is able to apply it to the challenges of today.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is, well, I couldn't say it better than you just did. And that is why it is so important that we get as many students as possible to the exhibition. We do that in Amsterdam, and we want to do that in New York as well. And to be honest, we're well underway. And that is indeed thanks to the philanthropic, through the funding, through philanthropic, et cetera, that we can do that, which is really amazing.
So what would you like visitors to take away from their experience at the exhibition?
I think there's actually two things they should take with them. And one is, of course, I hope they know a bit more about Anne's life and the circumstances that she had to live in and to endure. So more the historical side. But the exhibition ends actually with Otto Frank. In 1973, there was a school class in the Bronx, New York, that did a project, and they read Anne's diary. And these pupils, they were about, I think, 12, 13 years old. They all sent a letter to Otto Frank, and they expressed their feelings and that they were very overwhelmed by reading the diary and all that. And then Otto wrote, everyone who wrote a letter to Otto, he replied. And he wrote a beautiful letter back to this class. And he says, and I think that is an important takeaway message, he says, okay, I'm very glad that you read the diary, but I think it is even more important that we, that everyone in his own small circle learns to combat anti-Semitism, intolerance, and discrimination. And that is the real takeaway from this exhibition, that everyone can do something, even within their own small circle, like a family, a school class, a community.
And in the past, we've had people who've denied the Holocaust, who've denied the authenticity and the truth of Anne Frank's story. And in a way, we're becoming more used to these types of denials of the truth in our society and in our world, that the door has opened to people to create their own truth and to challenge the evidence of our eyes and of the past. And that's really a threat to our society, to our democracy, to our values as well.
I couldn't agree more. It is true. We've seen this in earlier years with people contesting the diary, whether it would be a falsification or not, or whether someone else would have written it or something like that. But we see that nowadays, if you go on like TikTok or Twitter, it's very, very hard to know what is true and what is not true, to make the distinction. And that is a different problem, but that is, really is a problem. I agree.
Okay, well, my thanks to Tom Brink, the head of collections and presentations at the Anne Frank House, for joining us tonight to talk to us about the life of Anne Frank and her remarkable legacy, because the Anne Frank House is presenting this pioneering experience outside of Amsterdam for the first time, so visitors can immerse themselves in a full-scale recreation of the rooms where she and her family lived, and they can also see so much more as well in terms of artifacts and documents and that whole immersive experience. It's running in the Center for Jewish History in New York City until the 31st of October this year. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. Dublin's old bilingual street signs with their unique Gaelic typeface are fast disappearing from the capital streets, but we are all being asked to help document and preserve them as part of a new digital humanities project led by Trinity College Dublin. And I'm delighted to welcome to the show Dr. Nicole Vollmering of the School of Histories and Humanities at Trinity College Dublin, who is leading this Closescape research project. Nicole, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about Closescape, the name, the idea behind this research project.
Sure. Closescape actually just is a combination of the Clo Gaelic and streetscape, combining the two things that I'm focusing on. It's Clo Gaelic in the streetscape. So Clo Gaelic just means the Irish typeface that's modelled on the script that's traditionally used to write Irish. And the project is currently creating a survey of where we find these signs in the Dublin streetscape.
So when do they come about? Do they date back to independence or do they go further back? Because some of them, I think, are the turn of the 20th century.
That's right. They go further back. Yes. Officially, they date back to 1901 when the Dublin Municipal Council voted to install bilingual signage in Dublin streets. Before that, there was a push from the Gaelic League and similar bodies to try and install these signs, but it was repeatedly, the motions that repeatedly failed. But in 1901, after the recent election, when there was a big change in politics, this was finally successful. And so from just after that, we find the first records of those typical green and white signs being commissioned for placement in the streets.
So what's so special about this Irish typeface? Why is it so important? And I suppose, how does it have so many links and connections going back centuries to manuscripts and to other sources?
That's because the font was modelled on the way Irish was written basically since the 6th century, since writing came to Ireland and when scribes first decided, how are we going to write down Irish? For all of this period, essentially, the script more or less remained fairly stable. And it was taught in schools right up until the 1970s. It's only after that time that Patrick Hillary, then in the Department of Education, decided to phase this out officially.
So why aren't these signs officially protected?
That's a good question. And I think it's primarily a practical question. I imagine it's simply too costly and too difficult to actually conserve them actively. So in lieu of that, I'm trying to preserve them digitally so that we at least still have them for the future.
So what are you asking us, the public, to do? How can we help preserve and ensure that at least we have some kind of digital record of these signs?
You can send me pictures of any signs that you come across. Now, we're obviously doing a modern survey at the moment already, but if you have any pictures, they're very welcome. And in particular, we're looking for historical photographs of these signs because they help us reconstruct the timeline.
So what has been your most surprising discovery so far? Because it seems like these are popping up in really unexpected places and some that have survived are really unexpected.
That's right. The ones in Dublin City, I suppose, are relatively straightforward. But the further out of Dublin you get, the more interesting signs you get in some ways. I think probably because they're less standardised as they were going up. So there's yellow ones and there's black ones and even a few white ones that I've spotted recently. And particularly in other areas that weren't, I suppose, monitored by Dublin City Council.
And in a way, we're getting a sense of local meanings for some of these areas. We're also getting some forgotten histories for particular streets or areas that, you know, would have been lost only for what we can learn from the name in Irish and the way the sign is written.
That's right. And I think if you start reading the signs, you'll notice that in a lot of cases, the Irish and the English don't particularly match. Even walking up here, just a sign for Drury Street, it's called an Shroud Beag, which obviously doesn't translate Drury Street. So that's quite common, and there's a whole history of translation and mistranslation relating to these signs as well, which is, I suppose, is a completely different chapter to be written. Yeah.
So in fact, we may have the wrong names for particular places. If we had been strictly translating them into English, we perhaps should have gone with different versions. So you're getting a sense of what the original history was, and perhaps a sense of why that place may have been called that original name.
Yes, in some cases you do. And in some cases it points to political debates as well, especially, of course, after the foundation of the Seerstadt, you get debates about whether street names are correct or whether they should be changed back to previous names or whether they should be changed to, say, names of the heroes of the Rising. Interestingly enough, a lot of those proposals actually fell flat and the street names were retained, even where they referred to prominent British politicians.
And do you see a broader cultural shift in how we value Irish language, how we value this typography?
In recent years, yes. I think there's more interest in the Irish language in general and also in Irish history. And I can see it with this project as well. I've already received numerous emails from the public with an interest in this. And I think while it's maybe not as much taught in schools at the moment, I think the general public has great interest into Ireland's long history. And I think one of the interesting things about Ireland as well is that you see history around you everywhere, not just in Dublin, but also outside of Dublin.
So how many photographs have you collected so far?
So far, about 600. And we're really only getting started in some ways. So there'll be many more, I'm sure. Yeah.
So if people want to, if people find some of these signs, they should write to you. And the email address is closescape, closescape at outlook.com. And are they able to look at what you've already gathered so they can check to see if they're duplicating something you might already have, or are you just wanting everyone to send them in and you'll just collate and collect them?
At the moment, I'm in collating and collecting phase. So I'm going about it, I suppose, by postal codes. So I'm processing Dublin 1 first, Dublin 2, etc. And those sections of the archive will be launched as soon as they're ready. So there isn't currently a list you can conveniently check. Unfortunately, that's a little bit too difficult to put together because I'd have to change it every day. But the archive will gradually start rolling out. It'll be found on the Digital Repository of Ireland.
Digital Repository of Ireland. And would these signs have been in every county in the country, or are they unique to Dublin?
They're definitely not unique to Dublin. There are plenty in Cork as well and in various other areas. Exactly where is still very much the question, though. I know some in Limerick as well, but certainly there isn't a survey of Dublin or the rest of the country. Cork has been fairly well surveyed, but apart from that, we really don't know. So if people know of any around the country, do get in touch, please.
This is absolutely brilliant because you could expand based on the brilliant success of this project. You could then expand it into the rest of the country and you could see which counties have them, which counties they're still there. And then maybe people might have older photographs where they might have been there at one point in time and have since been removed. And I'm really fascinated by how these predate Irish independence. The way they, I think you've described it as a kind of a, previously as a kind of a form of silent rebellion, the way that this was a sense of our Irishness, our cultural identity, and it was a way of projecting that identity even when we weren't independent.
Absolutely. And you see that a lot in the debates dating back to that time and even into the 20th century. There was a huge debate about the value of the Clo Gaeilge and whether or not it was the right way to print Irish. And that goes back all the way to 1850, really, when the Gaelicisation movement really starts to pick up. But the debate tended to centre around the value of the Clo Gaeilge as a reflection of Irish language and Irish heritage on the one hand, and a sense of modernization and progress on the other hand, which was associated with the what they would call the Roman type or English type. And this debate really raged for at least 100 years, and in some sections I think it's still going on. There were clashes both in the Dáil and in newspaper letters and among the public all through that period, and especially around whether or not the Clo Gaeilge should be used, say, in educational materials that were printed en masse, you know, around the 1920s with the foundation of the new state and the creation of the new national programme.
And these signs are beautiful. You know, I have some of the images here in front of me, and they're much more elegant. They're much more impressive than a lot of the signs that we have now. And do you feel that we've lost something, that it has become a little bit diminished, that our signs are much more functional, but a lot more prosaic now?
Absolutely, yes. Of course, they're no longer handmade either. So some of the variation that we see in those signs is because they were commissioned from different producers, I suppose, and in many cases handmade by local craftsmen. And the ones we have now are more sort of mass produced, and they contain, I think in most cases, the transport font, which is actually designed for British motorways. So it's really not, I suppose, suited to represent the Irish script. Yeah.
And when these signs are replaced, when they're taken down and a new modern version is put up, what happens to the old one?
That's a good question. As far as I know, they're not collected in any systematic way. So they seem to be just largely in people's houses or bars, or just get lost and destroyed. And this is happening almost on a yearly basis, even on a monthly basis. So I do know of some people, I think, who have some in their private collections. But really, they should be in a museum to where everyone can see them. Yeah.
So perhaps we could make a recommendation to the Department of Culture, given that we do have a new minister in place, and perhaps this is something that they might take up and decide that as signs are taken down and replaced and updated and so on, that perhaps the old one with this beautiful script and an important part of Ireland's cultural heritage, an important part of our national story, that these will be preserved, they will end up in a museum, and they will be available for people in later generations to see and appreciate.
That would be fantastic, yes. I would love that.
So what's next for the project? You're just going to continue this call for public support, have people gather these images, and then when you have collected them all, what are you going to do with them then?
Well, I suppose at the moment I'm focusing on Dublin to create the first volume of this archive. I'm hoping to then roll it out nationally beyond that. Once all the images are up, they're available for both researchers and the public alike. But for my own interest, I'm particularly interested in tracking down the rollout, who was involved in the decision making, who created the signs, who made the decisions around the street names, etc. Just to get a sense, especially around in the first half of the last century, how this interfaced with the political debates around the use of Irish.
Okay, well, we might just end by giving you that email address again. It's closescape@outlook.com, closescape. And my thanks to my guest, Dr. Nicole Vollmering of the School of Histories and Humanities at Trinity College Dublin, who is leading this brilliant Closescape research project and really helping to document and preserve our bilingual street signs, which really have been such a crucially important part of our cultural heritage. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. For centuries, the River Thames has witnessed London's major events and the everyday lives of Londoners, gradually revealing its secrets through the age-old practice of mudlarking. This year, London Museum presents Secrets of the Thames, an extraordinary collection of artefacts discovered by mudlarks who carefully searched the shore at each low tide. And I'm delighted to talk to Kate Sumnell, the creator of archaeology at London Museum and the creator of this wonderful new exhibition, Secrets of the Thames. Kate, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Can we talk about, first of all, the idea of mudlarking and who these mudlarks are?
Absolutely. So I think for as long as people have been living alongside the River Thames, so bits and pieces have been dropped in the river. And I think there would have always been people that were searching for things that could be used or could be sold. The very first records that we've got of the mudlarks go back into the 1700s, where there are some court records, which is actually a domestic violence case, but they refer to the woman in question as being a shorer, which from the description, it very much sounds like she was a mudlark. And so those early mudlarks, they were looking for scraps of rope, coal, metal, anything that could really be sold.
So in a way, they were excavating and trying to find what was being thrown up by the shore and trying to just make some money from it.
Exactly. I mean, the river has always been thronging with activity. And with the tide that goes out twice a day, it exposes the muddy banks on which bits and pieces that have been dropped or thrown away get sort of trapped. And so the mudlarks are down there just picking up whatever they can press into use or sell.
And this is an exhibition that blends archaeology with contemporary art, with digital experiences, so that it's really drawing together new technology as well as these artefacts as a way of offering a new perspective about London, its people and about its history.
That's right. So, yes, I spoke about those early mudlarks that were looking for bits and pieces that they could sell. Modern mudlarks today have got very different motivations, and they are really fascinated by history and the ancient artifacts that the Thames has also preserved. And so those are the bits and pieces that we're going to put on display in the exhibition. And it doesn't feel right or complete to be doing an exhibition all about mudlarked finds without also thinking about who are the mudlarks themselves, of what are their motivations that drives them there, even in the bitterest cold, to be down there pursuing their passion, searching for these ancient things.
Yes, it used to be, it's now a hobby for people, but it used to be a career or a matter of life and death, or certainly a way of surviving and eking out an existence. And I suppose it was also important for them to know about the tides, because they depended on low tide as a way of trying to do their searches.
Absolutely, that's right. So the tide is always changing. It shifts gradually later every single day, and it's tied to the movement of the moon. So some of the tides are much lower than others. It's also affected by the wind and the weather conditions. So those early mudlarks, I think they had such a deep knowledge of the river and its patterns, and sometimes its unpredictability as well, that they pursued this living that really was utterly desperate. These were people that were so impoverished that they had to resort to doing this. But they had such an instinctive way of reading the river and understanding it, and they would do it for years. So they kept themselves safe in what was a really dangerous environment.
And the exhibition features over 350 of these mudlarked objects. And there are some brilliant ones there. And I'm particularly impressed with the idea of the Shadwell Shams, the way Billy Smith and Charlie Eaton, two mudlarks, decided to use this mudlarking pursuit as a way of presenting their forgeries and legitimizing their forgeries and then giving them a way of, I suppose, creating a provenance and allowing them to sell them.
Absolutely. We've got these written accounts around the early mudlarks who name many of them. But the story of Billy and Charlie is just so intriguing and so very human that you can't help be drawn into them, of their sheer, confidence, just to really think that they could create artifacts from scratch, just working over a domestic hearth. And yeah, fool all archaeologists and antiquarians that were here. It was amazing, their skill and their confidence in doing this. It was really convincing.
And then you also have these kind of memento beads, where people would have them perhaps with their rosaries. They were a way of reminding people of their mortality, and that these were also things that kind of would turn up on the shore of the Thames.
Absolutely. So at that time, Catholicism was really common in London, and so many people would have carried rosary beads with them. And this is the bead that sits at the bottom, and it on one side it is beautifully carved bone. It's got the sides of a beautiful woman's face, and on the other side is a skull. And when the mudlark found it on the foreshore, it was the skull side that was just peeking out of the mud, the most intriguing object that caught her eye. And as she gradually revealed it and picked it up and then turned it over, this beautiful woman's face was looking back at her on the other side. And that then prompted her to go through all the research to understand just how this bead would have worn and how it would have absolutely encapsulated that never-ending circle between life and death that is true back then, but is also true for us today.
There's also an incredible iron knife that is more than 1,000 years old and it has the name Osmond on it, or a name that we think the runes, we think it spells Osmond. And, you know, there's a mystery about who made it, who owned it, but also perhaps whether it was a Viking knife or what its history is.
Yes, that's right. This is one of my favourite periods of history. It is before the medieval times, so yeah, it's about 1,000 years ago. And this iron knife, often iron doesn't survive in the ground at all, but thanks to the protective river mud, it has survived the test of time. And as you say, the name Osmond has been carefully inlaid in silver on this blade. At this time of the London area was lived in by the group of people known as the Saxons, but the Vikings were also sailing up the river, hoping to take strategic control of the Thames and also wanting access to the Saxon port, which was really profitable. And so we know from written accounts that there are a number of battles up and down the Thames. And so, yeah, it makes curiosity of just who was the Osmond and the knife. Was it the person who owned the knife? Was it the person who made the knife? And then did it belong to the Saxons or did it belong to the attacking Vikings? These are all the answers that we don't know. We have clues in archaeology. We get a number of things that we do know, but the complete picture, that's open to interpretation.
And there's even older things there as well. There's a part of a ring finger that has this gemstone, green gemstone, and it shows the sun god Sol driving a chariot pulled by four horses. And it looks like it's a Roman seal used 1,800 years ago.
Yes, now that's a remarkable discovery. As you said, it would have been worn in a finger ring. It's known as an intaglio. And it was found just lying on the surface of the foreshore. 2,000 years it's been resting there, right where the Romans built their city that they called Londinium. It's made from a green jasper stone that's been so carefully carved, showing these four horses and then the sun god as well. So it feeds into the Roman beliefs around the power of the sun god. It's showing that they are really central, known as Sol. And it just also carries a little bit of that power to the wearer as well. So the person who wore it would have been someone really quite important within the Roman world, within London.
There is a sense where, I suppose, historically, mudlarks would have scavenged out of necessity. Today's enthusiasts are driven by a passion for history and archaeology, and they seek these personal connections to the past. They seek that thrill of discovery. But there also seems to be a sense where some of these mudlarks believe that the object finds them as much as they find the object.
I think so. I think there's a real sense of fate, almost, that the river gifts mudlarks with these things. Of when you speak to the mudlarks about how they find things, there's an element of chance always. There's also skill in being able to spot often these tiny, tiny things that are nestling amongst all the natural rocks and things that are down there, and then all the rubbish that is modern London life. So it takes skill to be able to train your eye to find these tiny, tiny things. But you can, in speaking to some of the mudlarks, they talk about how, you know, they've searched an area, they've walked over it, and then someone coming along behind them just bends down and just seemingly spots it and picks it up. Of there is the feeling that that find was meant to go to that person, not to anyone else. Some of the mudlarks also think about, before they go searching, what they would most like to find. And they've got a bit of a wish list as to what they really want. And they just, before they go down to the river, they picture it, they imagine it. And it's just go down with so much hope that today is going to be the day that they find their key find.
And this is the first time there ever has been an exhibition in Britain dedicated to mudlarking. It's running until the 1st of March next year, so 2026. And it's incredible that it has taken so long for, I suppose, the idea of mudlarking to be seized upon as a great way of exploring the hidden world of London and exploring a part of London's history that really hasn't received that attention before.
That's right. It's a really great opportunity. It felt like this was the right time to be pulling together a major exhibition on mudlarking. It is a hobby that has just really grown in popularity in recent years, thanks to social media. But I would also say that the exhibition gives a great way of experiencing discovery and mudlarking without needing to go down to the river. If you do need a permit if you want to search the river, and that comes from the Port of London Authority.
And is there something about the type of mud that is in the River Thames that is ideal for preserving these objects? Because it just seems that the way leather, wood is being preserved and kept intact for centuries, it does seem that there is a unique environment there that is allowing for this exceptional preservation of the artefacts.
You're right. The river conditions do preserve objects really well. It's not unique to just London, that preservation of often many rivers around the country, around the world, are preserving in terms of they block out the oxygen, they stop things from rotting. But what we do have in London is the combination of that preserving mud and the Thames that is tidal, and also a foreshore that's solid enough that can be walked upon and can be searched. Other places, they don't have the combination of those three things, but I bet in the rivers there are absolutely fantastic artefacts.
Well, my thanks to Kate Sumnell, the curator of archaeology at London Museum and creator of this brilliant new exhibition, Secrets of the Thames, for joining us tonight. The exhibition is running from April this year to the 1st of March 2026, so March next year. It is running at the London Museum down in the Docklands, this exhibition, Secrets of the Thames. And Kate, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely speaking to you.
And you can find out more details from the London Museum website, londonmuseum.org.uk. If you love the water, fashion, or a bit of nostalgia, then the Design Museum in London has an exhibition for you. Splash, A Century of Swimming and Style, dives into 100 years of swimwear, culture and design, from Olympic triumphs to Baywatch icons. It's running to August this year, and it explores how swimming has shaped fashion, technology, and even architecture. And I'm delighted to welcome the curator, Amber Butchart, the dress and design historian and broadcaster, to the show tonight to discuss it. Amber, you're very welcome.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
Now, the most, I suppose, dramatic item that you have in the exhibition is Pamela Anderson's red bathing suit from Baywatch, and that's the one that has been grabbing all of the attention in the press releases, and I suppose it is probably the most iconic swimsuit in history.
Yeah, I would say that's probably true. We've borrowed it from the Bikini Art Museum in Germany, which is a museum entirely kind of dedicated to swimwear and bathing culture and all of these kinds of things. So I think it's a great time to be thinking about how that swimwear really impacted trends at the time and impacted body image as well.
And let's go back in time 100 years when swimwear began to be marketed for swimming rather than that idea of just having clothes for bathing. And it seems to be a time 100 years ago when the whole idea of even having a beach holiday, that was suddenly emerging on the scene.
Yeah, exactly. Throughout the 19th century, we'd seen the beach becoming quite a fashionable space, but for, you know, elites of society, for royalty, for people with a lot of money and a lot of leisure time as well. Even going back to the 18th century with these ideas around health and well-being, sea air, sea bathing, all of these kinds of things. From the 20s onwards, we start seeing this becoming a bit more democratic, especially in the 30s. We see kind of legislation passed that allows more people to take more time off and paid time off as well. We see more bank holidays created. So lots of things that allow, you know, many, many more people really to enjoy leisure time by the coast.
And the exhibition really takes the story right up to the present day about swimming's role in modern life, but also, I suppose, how what we wear also influences so much in society.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, if we think about what we wear by the beach, by the coast or by the pool, there is an interesting relationship with kind of what we wear in other spaces as well. And we do quite often see that stuff that's worn on holiday or worn by water can be a bit more daring, a bit more exciting than what is worn in kind of urban spaces. And we see this again from 100 years ago with the trend for beach pajamas that really flourished around the coastlines of Europe. And then, you know, kind of Britain and the UK as well from the 1920s. This is women wearing trousers, wide cut, beautiful flowing trousers. This is a period when it's really unacceptable for women to be wearing trousers at any, you know, in any other kind of context, really, unless it's the privacy of their own home. So this idea of women in public in trousers becomes acceptable at the beach before it's acceptable elsewhere.
Talk to me about the bikini and how that developed, how it evolved, and even how it got its name.
Well, the bikini is a very interesting item with a very specific historic context. Now, two-piece swimwear had been worn previously, at least since the kind of 1920s, 1930s. But the first time it's actually called a bikini is in 1946. And it's a French designer, Louis Riard. He creates this very tiny two-piece swimsuit, smaller than we've ever seen before. And he names it the bikini. And he names it the bikini after Bikini Atoll, which is the location of American nuclear test explosions at that time. So the reason he calls it the bikini is because he believes, A, it's atomic in size, it's tiny, it's minuscule, and B, it will have an impact of kind of explosive proportions. So in many ways, this is seems incredibly bad taste to us today. This is, you know, just 1 year after the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's horrendous. But these ideas all entered pop culture at this time. And you even get spots in like Las Vegas where it was popular as a tourist attraction to go to hotels and watch the nuclear test explosions that were happening in the Nevada desert. So again, quite impossible for us today to imagine, but this is something that was really emerging out of what was becoming the Cold War.
And you have one of the earliest surviving designs on display in the exhibition, and it had newsprint on it.
Yes, exactly. So we have one by Louis Riard. His first one was 1946, and then it was newspaper print design. And then he created one in every collection for a good few years. We have one from 1951, which is very exciting. And it's got newsprint, as you say, all over it. It says it's got headlines saying things like bikini, referencing places like Deauville, which was a very fashionable resort in northern France. So really tying all those themes together.
But it also has some ridiculous pieces. And I just can't understand how people had woolen swimsuits, and you have one on display from 1933 for men. But what was the point of a woolen swimsuit?
Well, before synthetic fabrics and fibres were available, wool was really the only kind of fabric that you could get enough stretch into. So we see in the 20s and just before that, a lot of innovations in knitting machines that could create quite form-fitting, quite stretchy knitwear. And like I say, this is before nylon, this is before polyester is developed. So there really aren't that many options. And it seems very odd for us today to be wearing woolen swimsuits. We think of wool as jumpers and, you know, this kind of, you know, cozy outerwear that you definitely don't want to get wet. But in a period before the textile technology is available, that's very much the best option.
Well, in terms of then the synthetic materials and the radical designs that follow, talk to me about Speedos, because Speedos are synonymous with a particular type of outfit, even if it's not made by Speedos.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because most swimwear exhibitions in the past have really tracked the, you know, the tiny sizes of women's swimwear, how women's swimwear gets smaller and smaller. And we see that with the bikini that we've just discussed. But similar things do happen with menswear. And the Speedo is a really, really great example of that. We see developments in the 1960s. And there was a particular designer, Peter Travis, working in Australia for Speedo in the 1960s. And he is creating this really form-fitting, tiny swimwear that really shows off a man's body. So kind of bringing his own gay gaze really to his designs, and it becomes very, very popular. At first, it's very controversial, and you get, you know, the police are called into some beaches in Sydney. You know, there are arrests, or, you know, the possibility of arrests, because it's seen that men are wearing these items that are really, really too small to be worn in public. But of course, it becomes very popular, and by the time we get into the 70s, and especially the 1972 Olympics, we're starting to see the kind of Speedo design that we think of today, that kind of very diminutive size being worn by Olympic athletes.
And then some of the outfits were controversial. The El Zior racer swimsuit was a high-performance swimsuit developed, but it was eventually banned from all competitions because the suit was so advanced it was deemed technical doping.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting thing. When we think of doping and sport, we tend to think of it as something that we specifically take, you know, ingest into our bodies, drugs or blood or all of this kind of stuff. But technical doping certainly was what was levied at this particular swimsuit. It was something like over 90% of the swimmers who won gold at the Beijing Olympics in 2008 were wearing this particular laser racer swimsuit created by Speedo. They'd been working with NASA scientists, which is very exciting, to try to create the most like hydrodynamic swimsuit that had ever been created. But it was seen by the governing body, this sort of international governing body of swimming, that this was just not a fair development, that if this many people are going to win gold when they're wearing this particular swimsuit, then it's not about ability, it's about what you're wearing. And so it was banned for technical doping.
In Ireland, we're very proud of our swimming Olympians of recent years, Daniel Whiffen, Mona McSharry, and the exhibition celebrates some of the British Olympians in swimming.
It does. We have some swimwear from Tom Daly. We have some swimwear on display from Alice Deering. And we also think right back into some of the earlier Olympians as well. Like, for example, there was a woman called Lucy Morton who competed. She was from Blackpool. She competed in the 1924 Olympics in Paris and became the first woman, British woman, to win gold for solo swimming. So we have her gold medal on display, which is really, really exciting. And she went on to perform at Blackpool Tower and to train future Olympic stars as well. We also focus a bit on Judy Grinham, who won gold in the 1956 Melbourne Olympics. And so really a big part of this was about not only celebrating swimmers today, especially people like Alice Deering, who co-founded the Black Swimming Association, Tom Daly, who does so much for LGBTQ plus rights for athletes as well, but also looking back into these swimming champions of the past, especially women champions who have maybe not been remembered as well as they should have been.
And I mentioned that architecture and the influence of swimming on architecture is also a feature of it. And that's a dimension that I wouldn't have considered, the way certain things are designed. For example, the Jubilee Pool from the 1930s had this unusual triangular shape, or the London Aquatic Centre was an architectural landmark of the 2012 Olympics. And even things like saunas and beach huts and public baths, they're all an important part of the story.
Yeah, they very much are. We really feature architecture throughout the show. And I think what is particularly interesting about architecture as it relates to swimming and leisure is that there is such a strong social history behind it as well. If we think about swimming in Britain and swimming pools, they were initially created. There was this grand kind of wave of civic architecture in the late 19th century, mid to late 19th century, but it was about sanitation. They were created as wash houses, as laundries. These were places where people living in really overcrowded urban spaces could come and could be clean. And they were created in the wake of cholera epidemics. So it was really a public health measure. It's only really when we start to move into the 20th century that these places become associated with swimming rather than actually sanitation. And we see that a lot of them being redeveloped in the 1930s with ideas of what we now know as Art Deco.
Well, it's a brilliant new exhibition. The creator is Amber Butchart, who's the dress and design historian and broadcaster. It's called Splash, A Century of Swimming and Style, and it's running in the Design Museum in London. Amber, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and also Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.